Glad to have all of you back, and in some ways this is a good session because you've had a chance to stretch your legs. In some ways it's not a good session because you've had a chance to fill your tummies. But my goal here is for this to obviously hopefully be edifying but also be participatory. And to the extent it's participatory will depend upon you. That may cause me to rein in the participation a little bit so that it remains edifying. But if you don't mind, I just think that a subject like this, without your input and your comments and your questions, will just be a half a loaf, maybe not even a half a loaf. Let me give you an idea of how I intend to go about these sessions. I will spend the first 50 to 55 minutes going over some material, giving you a chance periodically to make a comment or a question, and if you've just got a compelling comment or question that can't wait, I'll try to see your hand. I'm going to set aside the last 15 minutes or so each day to looking at specific issues, and I'm going to call this, for want of a better word, how do you handle things? And within our congregations, within leaders in our congregation, and let me just give you, I haven't decided on which ones of these I'm going to do, but to give you an idea of where my mind is coming from, and if you have some you would definitely like for me to consider having a discussion, public discussion about, feel free to let me have them. But I just jotted down some things that sometimes in our congregations and our leaders are difficult. Dealing with delinquent children of members. Dealing with a new charismatic member. How do we deal with sinful officers? How do we deal with ineffective officers, elders, deacons, evangelists? How do we revitalize a dead congregation? How do we keep from losing our members and our youth? How do we handle members who want the elders to do the work for them? How do we handle church discipline? Are women usurping too much authority in our congregations? Those are the types of things I have in mind. I'm sure there's others that are more important that you might have in mind, so you can give me an idea. Today, if I manage my time, we're going to deal with how to handle out-of-control situations in a congregation. Well, that's a never-ending topic because everything bad could go under that, but I'll save that. But I just wanted to give you a little flavor of what I was hoping to do, and I definitely want your participation there, or sharing, or whatever you want to consider it. So if you have things along those lines that you've seen in your congregation or some of you have encountered that you think it would be edifying for us to consider as a group, let me know, and I'll do my best to address them from up here, and if I don't feel that's appropriate, I'll do my best to visit with you privately about them. Have you ever heard someone say, "I'm just not a leader"? I've heard it many, many times. And probably some of us gathered together here feel like that about ourselves. We're just not leaders. Well, I want to say you're dead wrong. Everybody here is a leader. It is not an option. Now, you may be a good leader. You may be a great leader. You may be a bad leader. But you are a leader. I am not in these sessions going to go to 1 Timothy 3 and Titus chapter 1. If there are specific questions about any of the qualifications for officers, I'll be happy to comment on them. But I think this group has gone through that probably numerous times. Probably one or two that I may touch on as the weeks go on is the elder of one wife and having faithful children. Those often come up as question marks. But I think you've studied those, and if you have questions about it, I'll be happy to visit with you about it. But I'm going to approach it in a more general sense. What are the characteristics of great leaders? And how can all of us be better leaders? If you're a bad leader, how can you become a good one? If you're a good one, how can you become a great one? If you're a great one, then you might as well go home and write a book so the rest of us can learn how to do it. Because I am not one of those. We probably do have some great leaders in our midst, but they would be probably the last ones to want to comment on that. But you simply cannot ignore leadership when evaluating an organization. Now, my topic is church leadership. Charles, in the next hour, will be talking about the Christian family, and I'm sure he'll have some comments throughout his presentations about leadership in the home. So I'm not going to be talking about that, but many of the principles I will use with church leadership, he would use with family leadership, because there is a similarity there. But whether it's in the church, whether it's in our civic organizations, whether it's in our secular workplaces, or whether it's in our homes, you can't ignore leadership. But there are different levels of effectiveness of leaders. What is leadership? Well, in its simplest terms, leadership is simply the exercising of influence. If you influence people, you are by default a leader. And all of us influence. If you're a teenager, in some realms, you're a leader. You ladies, you are leaders. You men, you are leaders. Whether you're elders, deacons, evangelists, or whatever, you are leaders, because we all influence others. Certainly it is true, no man or woman is an island. But as I said, there are bad leaders, there are good leaders, there are great leaders. What there aren't are non-leaders. Now, do I wish that I could be a non-leader lots of times? Absolutely, and so do you. I just don't believe it's an option. So we have to decide, okay, I'm going to be influencing people, so now how can I do it in the best possible way? Stu Weber, in some of his writings, repeatedly said, someone is always in charge. And I believe that in 99% of the cases. Now, there could be a case where there's a sudden panic, and it appears that nobody is in charge for a few moments. But even in a sudden panic, someone eventually, if smoke starts filling this room, there'd be a moment of maybe a little panic, and we'd wonder who's in charge. But some of you would start telling us how to exit, ushering us out, and make sure we made it. I don't know which ones of you it would be, but leaders do come. I don't believe there are any congregations that do not have leaders. There are congregations that don't have elders and deacons, but there are no congregations that don't have leaders, because someone always is a leader, de facto or by design. If you have more than one person involved in any task, someone will always be in charge. I think that's a key that I want to stress, because I don't want you to approach this class with, well, I'm not an elder, I'll never be an elder, I'll never be a deacon, I'll never be an evangelist, I'll never be the wife of any of those. Well, that may or may not be true, but it is irrelevant to the importance of the subject of being a Christian leader for you and for me. Leadership is important in our workplace, in our social gatherings, and in the church. As I said, Charles will deal with the home setting and whatever way he deems appropriate. We're going to be looking at biblical passages on Christian leadership, and we're going to be looking at some biblical examples of Christian leaders, many of which were not always good leaders. Some of the people we're going to be talking about in the next 2 weeks, you and I might immediately say, well, they were a good leader, but when you go back and look at their lives, they had a lot of learning to do. In fact, I'm not sure anybody but Jesus was always a great leader. There are great leaders in the Bible, but many of them, most of them, if not all of them, did not start that way. As I put these sessions together, and this will be my confession, and then I'll move on, my view of myself as a leader has been lowered. As I put these sessions together and been asked and pleasantly consider this topic, I look at myself and say, John, you are not as good a leader as you thought you were. Now, I'm just being dead honest with you. Now, that doesn't discourage me, because as I go through the Bible, all the great leaders had to learn. What will discourage me is if I don't learn how to be a better leader, and you don't learn how to be better leaders. What makes a leader? Is it rank? Is it status? Is it clout? Is it style? Well, the answer is none of the above. You may have a title. You may be president, you may be CEO, you may be elder, you may be deacon. That title does not make you a leader. It means you should be a leader, but it does not make you a leader. But Jesus, I believe, answered in very few words, as he often did, what a leader is. And I'm going to turn to Matthew chapter 20, verses 25 and 28. And I'm not putting these scriptures on the board because you can either listen to me or you can turn to them. I think there's some benefit in, at least to some extent, us turning to these so that they solidify in our minds a little bit and keep our minds a little more agile. In Matthew chapter 20, I'm going to read verses 25 through 28. But Jesus called them unto him and said, "You know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority upon them. But it shall not be so among you." This is the way the world does it, but that's not the way I want you to do it. "Whosoever will be great among you, let him be your minister. And whosoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant. Even as the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many." Christ says in those verses, Christian, true Christian leadership demands, number one, service. It demands, number two, sacrifice. And it demands, number three, selflessness. Those aren't my words, those are the words of Jesus. Leadership is service, sacrifice, and selflessness. Which probably explains to us why Christian leadership is relatively rare and so hard even for us to attain. Proud, self-promoting people are not good leaders according to the standards of Christ. I'm going to repeat that. Proud and self-promoting people, people that want to tell us all they have done, and I don't care how good what they have done is, are not leaders according to Jesus. And that is not the way the world views it. But you remember what Jesus said in John 18:36, "My kingdom is not of this world." Now, a man or a woman who is successful in the secular place might be good Christian leaders, but they are not good Christian leaders because they are successful in the secular place. And because of pride, they might be good Christian leaders in spite of being successful in the secular workplace. It's therefore foolish for Christians to assume, as many do, that the best way for Christians to learn leadership is from world examples. I do not believe you are going to learn how to be a Christian leader from Sam Walton, Zig Ziglar, or John Maxwell. That does not mean they have no valid things for us to consider, but they're not engaged in Christian leaders. You're not going to learn how to be a good Christian leader by reading the latest religious books on leadership, or going to the latest seminar by a Bible college on leadership. That's exactly the way, however, sadly, a lot of the religious world has approached it, trying to make religious leaders much like, and their religious organization structured much like the corporate world. That was never God's intent. God designed a church that is very horizontal in its structure and not vertical. The world has designed corporate structures that are very vertical. That may be good, that may be bad, but it is not right for the church. Leadership for Christians always requires a spirituality. Therefore, Christians, if they lead in the secular place, and many of you do, your managers, you supervise people, you lead in companies, in civic organizations, maybe on school boards. If you do, then that spiritual dimension that you have as a Christian has to go with you in those roles. I'm not saying you can foist your views upon everybody you lead, but we have to conduct ourselves as Christians in our secular leadership roles and not simply in our Christian leadership roles. Every leader who is a Christian, be it a foreman, a manager, a president, must remember that leadership is a spiritual responsibility, and the people we lead will one day give an account for it. Now, Christ brought us to an exemplified servant leadership. Sometimes it's called the towel and the basin approach. Remember in John chapter 13, Jesus took the towel and the basin and washed their feet? You'll find some people refer to Christian leadership as the towel and basin leadership approach. Well, that's kind of a catchy phrase, but I just told you you're not going to learn how to do it from books, so I shouldn't quote them unduly. But we can learn from them. Many humble people, however, are not leaders. I believe all great leaders are humble, but not all humble people are great leaders. But it is an essential aspect. Leadership is influence. I'll repeat that probably more than once. And in its simplest terms, all are leaders because we all influence. But godly leaders lead by godly examples. Worldly leaders often lead by manipulation, threats, and rewards. Ever seen in a Christian organ in the church someone try to lead by threats, manipulation, and rewards? I don't even want you to move your heads. Just move your minds. Well, when that happens, somebody is trying to take secular leadership and apply it to church leadership, and I think that's a terrible, terrible mistake. Is everyone supposed to be a leader? I said everyone is a leader. Is everyone supposed to be a leader? Well, yes, but not everyone is called to lead in the same way, at the same level. If they were, then leadership by definition would be almost a redundant phrase. But you remember what Jesus says in Matthew 28, 19 and 20, go and do what? Teach. Baptizing. That's leadership. Maybe not from the pulpit, maybe not as an official office, but you're leading people to Christ. In Hebrews chapter 5, verse 12, the writer there leaves us with the admonition, For when for the time you ought to be teachers, you have need that one teach you again, which be the first principles of the oracles of God, and are become such as have need of milk and not of strong meat. When you ought to be teachers, well, what is a teacher? A teacher is a leader. I think Brother Grant had to leave us, but I was talking to Grant yesterday during one of our intermissions, and I knew he wasn't going to be here, so I gave him a couple of bullets of some of the things I was going to say, and he started smiling, and he said, when I was going to college in Warrensburg, Missouri, one of his professors came in and asked the class, what is a teacher? And several people gave various answers, like it's someone that imparts knowledge, that influences people. Sounded like right answers to Grant and I, and the teacher said, wrong. A teacher is someone who has a degree, a certificate, and belongs to the teachers' union. To which I told Grant, I hope you got out of that class. He said, I had to stay. I needed the credits. But that is so wrong. So nauseatingly wrong. Now, we're going to be discussing various styles of leadership. And I find various styles of leadership in the Bible. Moses, he delegated. Elijah, somewhat of a loner. Peter, brash and loud. Paul, hard driving. Aaron was eloquent. Their styles varied greatly. And in various ways, they were all effective and sometimes ineffective leaders. But today, many feel that faith and dedication need modern techniques and skills to allow us to lead. I believe the mistake for us to be more focused on the latest leadership trend, it is a mistake for us to be more focused on the latest leadership trend than we are to the scriptures that teach us. Just because the leadership style and techniques works in the business world does not necessarily mean It's what the church needs. Just because it works in the classroom of our schools doesn't mean that's what the church needs. We can't show biblical leadership and then following the world's fads. The world's styles do not fit the Bible, but the Bible's styles will always fit the world if we'll apply them. Christians ought to be the trendsetters, not the trend followers. As I said, not all of us will be elders or deacons or wives of elders and deacons, but every Christian is called to be a leader. Matthew 28, Hebrews 5. I want to look now for just a moment at leadership styles. I'll probably spend almost a whole session on leadership styles, but there are many styles in the Bible. But I believe successful church leadership is far more about character than it is style. What did Moses, Elijah, Peter, and Paul have in common? It was not their style, it was their character. I know many elders, I know many Christians, many of whom are leaders. Different styles. But successful ones have character. Now there is a tension that I believe sometimes we feel in the church. And when I'm talking about this, I'm probably talking a little bit more about the official offices like elder and deacon or evangelist, but it's not exclusively that. In 1 Timothy chapter 3, verse 1, and I told you I wasn't going to go there, but I do need to comment on this. It says, if a man desires the work, he desires a good work. And probably you, like me, have struggled with that word desire. Who wants to be an elder? Well, I can tell you who wants to be an elder. Someone who's never been one. Because if you've been one, you'd be probably fairly happy to turn it over to somebody. It's like in the workplace. You've seen these people. They can't wait to be a manager. They become a manager. And then what in the world have I got myself into? And in Jeremiah chapter 45, verse 5, it says, seek not things for yourself. Now, how do I reconcile desiring to have it and then seek not things for yourself? Isn't it better not to seek the position and have the position seek you? You ever seen someone, and I am talking about offices in the church now, it almost campaign for office? Or let it be known so widespread that they want it that you almost feel guilty if you don't submit their name? Well, let me give you my humble opinion. If you ever see someone like that, they have immediately told you they are not qualified to be an officer in the Lord's church. But it does say we should desire. I believe the word desire there means to want to serve, not wanting the glory, but wanting to serve and help in any way we can. When our ambition is to be effective in our service to God, then we're on the right track. When our ambition is to be the leader, we may have a problem. We may have a problem. Now, the first century church's leaders, a lot different than we are. There's a tendency, and I'm not necessarily talking about our congregations, but in the religious world, to view leadership as a place of honor and glory. I think in the first century, to be an officer of the church was anything but honor and glory. It probably meant you got the brunt of the persecution. And that's not something we're familiar with and can relate to. The idea here that Jeremiah is telling us is don't seek it for yourself. I take that to be very similar to what Jesus says about treasures in Matthew chapter 6, verse 19 and 20. Lay not up for yourselves treasures for yourself. He doesn't say don't lay up treasures. He said don't do it for yourself. It's the motive that's wrong. You can be rich and a Christian. I think it's more of a temptation when we are, but we're all rich just by the fact that we were born and live here. It's the for ourselves. It is one's motivation that determines the rightness or the wrongness of it. Ambition is kind of a word. It comes from a Latin word that means to campaigning for promotion and social visibility. But I think there can be a godly ambition if that ambition is to serve the Lord. Would you consider Moses to be a great leader? Just how many hands would say Moses was a good leader? Sure, I would. Do you realize that not once in the scriptures did God call Moses a leader? He calls him a servant. Never in scripture is Moses called a leader. Does that mean he wasn't a leader? No. I believe it means God knows his leaders by their servanthood, not by what we would commonly think of as leaders. I'm going to pause here. I don't know if I've said anything that would stimulate a comment or a question, but this is to be a class and not a monologue. So I give you the opportunity. Kimber. And we're going to look at that in great detail probably about Wednesday or Thursday. It's been my experience, even in church, one of the hardest things for Christian leaders to do is to delegate. And that's an interesting analysis as to why that is. I understand why it is, but it can be crippling. Sure. Shepherds always remain sheep. That's the thing sometimes we forget. Shepherds always remain sheep in one sense of the word, which means they need to learn. They need to continue to learn. And then some of the examples we're going to look at in these 2 weeks are men who were adequate leaders who became great leaders, and women. I'm going to look at one or two women that I think were adequate leaders, and some of them poor leaders that became good or great leaders, and they had to learn it, which I take great comfort in, because I don't think I'm as good a leader as probably I might have thought at one time, at least if my notes are correct. And you'll notice that as we go through this. Anybody else have a comment? Vic?
The comment you made is a dawning of awareness, John, about servant leadership. So much so, University of Chicago in the UMBA program, they have, as part of the reading, servant leadership, which is modeled, of course, from Christ. So there is a dawning of realization that it is important, but as to its place in business, well, let's hope that it's not too far of it.
Yeah, I like I'm sure you have been, Vic, when I was in the secular workplace, thousands and thousands of dollars were spent sending us to leadership things, and then you go back to your company and everyone looks at you with their, what kind of new stuff's he coming back with that we're going to have to put up with for a few weeks, and it kind of falls flat at that point. And you probably implemented it better than I did, but I think there's an intellectual awakening to it. I'm yet to be convinced that there is going to be a practical implementation of it, because the generations that preceded us were very autocratic. And we've become politically correct is to be diplomatic. I don't know how diplomatic we are. And I share the frustration, you know, as parents. And Charles, I don't mean to get into yours, but you get up and say, well, I'm going to listen to my kids and really let them have input. And by the end of the day, you're saying, because I said so. You know, enough of this participatory stuff at home. And I'm not advocating one way or the other. Charles will tell us how to raise our children. I'd like for you to look at Ezekiel chapter 22. God has always been searching for leaders. And sometimes people ask me, what is the most glaring need in the church today? I have no question in my mind what it is. It's qualified elders and deacons. Do we need more of other things? Yes. But if you ask me the thing we're hurting most for, It would be qualified elders and deacons. And if I had to pick there, that's an easy pick. It's qualified elders. Because rightly or wrongly, we place the bars at a little different level. And this will dovetail with, in my opinion, with Charles's class, because one of the reasons we have trouble getting elders in the church is because of domestic issues. Not the only reason, but it is, in my experience, the number one reason. Exodus, Ezekiel chapter 22 and verse 30. God says, "And I sought for a man among them that would make up the hedge and stand in the gap before me for the land, that I should not destroy it." Now, I wish that verse ended right there, but it doesn't. It ends with these words, "But I found none." There was no Noahs. There were no Abrahams. There were no Moseses. God said, "I just didn't find any." How sad. Just a few passages. I'm not going to turn and read these. I'll give them to you if you want to jot them down. 1 Samuel 13 and 14, God's looking for a leader. Jeremiah chapter 5, verse 1, God's looking for a leader. And verses from a whole plethora of verses. So it's not something new. But I'm not primarily focused now upon turning everybody here into an elder or a deacon or evangelist or the wife of. I'm interested in turning us all into better leaders. Issues that seems to me to be more effective than that issue between men, for whatever reason. Well, God had a master principle. But his leaders had to be, number one, they have to be authoritative. And by that I mean, as Christian leaders, we have to know where we are going and have confidence about where we are going. And where do we get that? Well, we get that from God's Word and His Holy Spirit. I believe Christian leaders obviously have to be spiritual. Without that, you might be a leader, but you're not going to be a Christian leader. So they need to know where they are going, and they need to be going in God's way. And they again need to be sacrificial, a serving attitude. Good, godly leadership falls to those who practice the discipline of seeking first the kingdom of God. J. Oswald Sanders, and if I were going to recommend a book, there's a couple, but this would be one. J. Oswald Sanders wrote a book on leadership, and some of my material will come from him. I don't agree with anything any one book says except the Bible, but there are a lot of good in there. And I extracted this quote. J. Oswald Sanders wrote, "If those who hold influence over others, and that's all of us, fail to lead toward the spiritual uplands, then surely the paths to the lowlands will be well worn." In other words, if you and I don't act like Christian leaders, nobody is. And the spiritual lowlands are going to be crowded, and the spiritual high ground is going to be desolate. In Mark chapter 10, very similar to what I read in Matthew, but I will take a look at this. In Mark chapter 10, verses 43 and 44, I believe we have again that master principle that God gave us about leadership. Mark chapter 10, verse 43. "But so shall it not be among you, but whosoever will be great among you shall be your minister, and whosoever shall be chiefest shall be your servant." It's interesting, when you go to the concordances and look up leader and leaders, it is not in the Bible very often. In the King James Version, the word leader is only in the Bible three times, and the word leaders is in the Bible three times. Six times. Now, there are other synonyms, I'll grant you that. For sake of the tape, 1 Chronicles 12:27, 1 Chronicles 13:11, Isaiah 55 and 4, in the King James, use the word leader. The word leaders is used in 2 Chronicles 32:21, Isaiah 9:16, and Matthew 15:14. Now, if you want to find that a little more interesting, as I do, only one of those six is in the New Testament. And the one in the New Testament is used in a negative context. Now, that does not mean God does not want us to be leaders. It just, I think, exemplifies the different way he looks at leadership than we tend to. In Galatians chapter 5, I don't know if I put this one on here or not. Nope, I didn't. In Galatians chapter 5, verse 13, it talks about we're to serve one another. Only once did Jesus say he would be even an example to his disciples, and that is in John 13, 15. Now, Peter does write about Christ, our example, in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 21, but only those two times really is that concept written in that way. But we know Jesus was the ultimate leader. I'm trying to stress how much differently, probably, in order to become good leaders, we're going to have to maybe look at some of the things that we do. Can we approve as leaders? Well, the answer is obviously yes. Even the most arrogant person here would say that they can improve. I hope you would believe it, but even if you don't believe it, you'd say it just so you wouldn't get laughed out of the room. I put a series of questions up here that all of us maybe could ask ourselves to kind of do a little self-evaluation of where we are as leaders. Number one, do other people's failures annoy you, challenge you, or please you? When somebody messes up, does that aggravate you or make you happy? Well, I know we're all wanting to say it might annoy us. None of us want to say it makes us happy, but I believe in the honesty of the recesses of most people's hearts, we are often happy when somebody messes up because it makes us feel better about ourselves. It's that comparative, competitive thing that's in us. Well, he messed that song up, so I must be as good a song leader as he is. That's totally irrelevant to God, but sometimes it creeps into our minds. Do you use people or cultivate people? Well, I think it should be obvious which good leaders do and which bad leaders do. Do you direct people or develop people? We're going to spend a session on developing leaders because that's a crucial thing in the church. Many times in the church, in the offices of elders and deacons, we just assume that they're going to be there when we need them. We don't do anything to develop them. And we don't really do anything till somebody dies. Seems to me like there ought to be a better trigger than a death. Do you criticize or encourage? We all know what we want to say, but that's irrelevant. Just ask yourself, which do you do most? Do you avoid or do you seek out those with special needs or problems? Now, if you honestly answer in kind of a poor way or a negative way to these questions, that does not mean you are not a leader. It certainly does not mean you cannot become a leader, but it may point up some things you and I need to work on. And I imagine everybody here is going to have to say yes to at least two or three of those. If you can honestly say yes to all of them, please see me after class. Because we need a mind meld. Because I can't say yes to very many of those. Often. Just a few traits that hinder leadership. I want to leave time for our discussion. Good leaders are not overly sensitive. We might say good leaders are thick-skinned. One of the problems many of us have is that we have thick hearts and thin skin. And we need to have thin hearts and thick skin. We've got it backwards. A hindrance to leadership is the tendency to blame other things when things don't go right that we've done. Well, this would have been a great class if Charles hadn't messed up my PowerPoint. He didn't. He was very helpful. But if it fails, now you know what I'm going to say. If you tend to be intolerant or impatient, periodically. As I look down these would be good hindrances to marriage too, but that's not my topic. If you are a perfectionist, do me a favor and stay away. Because you're going to be awfully hard to live with. And I think usually perfectionists have trouble even living with themselves. I am not a perfectionist. And I don't condone slothfulness, but I'm glad I'm not a perfectionist, because I think that would be a very stressful way to be. And there's probably some here that are, and I should be closer to it. But they tend to be very hard on themselves and hard on people. Do you have loose lips? I almost put, can you keep your mouth shut? But loose lips seemed a little better. Do you want to appear infallible? If you've got any of those traits, those are things you and to the extent I have them need to work on, because they are going to hinder our leadership. Okay, I've got just a couple of minutes, and I'm going to spend not time on 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1, but in general, in specifics, but let me go through. When you go through the traits that he gives for officers there, you can kind of divide them into probably six categories. And I've done that here. I've not put them under each category, but I've called them, and these are not new terms. You can find them in other writings. There are social qualifications for leaders in the church. Above reproach, of a good reputation. Those would be social qualifications. There are also moral qualifications. Our leaders are to be faithful, not addicted to wine. Those would be under what I would call moral qualifications. There are mental qualifications. They're to have sound judgment. They're to be apt to teach, both of them not to be a striker or a fight picker. They're to be hospitable, which could also fall under social. They're not to be the lovers of money. There are obviously some domestic qualifications. Elders and deacons are to be married and to have children. And they're to be careful not to neglect their families for the church's work. And lastly, what I would simply call maturity qualifications. They're not to be a novice. Now, you can go back and look at the 23 or 24 qualifications for officers that we have in 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1 and fit them under those various categories, or add a category or change one of those names. But when I look at that, we are to be, as all Christians, socially, morally, mentally, personally, domestically, and mature. Now, all Christians don't have to be married and don't have to have children. But other than that, all of those are things we ought to all probably strive for. And that's not wrong to strive for those, but I don't think anyone's salvation hinges upon whether they're married or have children. In fact, we know definitely that it does not. Now I'm going to pause one more time and see if you have any comments or questions on anything. I know this has been a little bit introductory. What I'm going to do in the subsequent days is we're going to deal with various characteristics, and I want to look at courage it takes to be a leader, the ability to delegate it takes to be a leader, integrity that it takes to be a leader, praise versus criticism as a leader, and we're going to spend two or three days on various things, and these would apply to elders and deacons, but they would apply to all of us as we try to lead. Does anybody have a comment or a question you would like to make before I quit that? Keith?
John, would you comment on the contrast between being authoritative and authoritarian? Because sometimes people mix those terms.
Yeah, if I'm I know what how I would use them. If I'm understanding what you're saying, we should be authoritative and not be authoritarian. And by that I mean our authority as leaders, Christian leaders, comes from the authority that God has given us and His Word, as opposed to being dictatorial. I equate one of those terms more to dictatorial, and one of them to being sure and steady. And we need to be sure and steady, but we don't have to do that in a dictatorial way. And when we talk about styles of leadership, One of the worst styles of leadership in any format, but certainly in the church, is the dictatorial approach. It is, in some ways, it's the easiest, but it's the least effective. And some people like to be under that. Now, I have great respect for the military, but I believe some people join the military so that people will tell them what to do, because the military tends to be very dictatorial, and it needs to be in order to function. But the church has to have absolute authority, but not in a dictatorial sense. And that is hard, especially if you've been raised to be a dictator, or that's been your role model. Thank you. Anybody else have a... And if I don't see your hand, please feel free to raise it up. Okay, before I go to...
Joanne.
I'm sorry. Where are we at? Joanne, how'd you let me not see you?
You said that church leadership requires service, sacrifice, and selflessness. Is it possible to miss one of those?
Sure. Her question is, I said that Christian leadership requires service, sacrifice, and selflessness. Is it possible to miss one of those? Absolutely. But I think when we miss one of those, we become less good, less effective. If you miss one of those, you might still be a good leader, but not a great leader. If you miss two of them, you might be a bad leader instead of a... I don't know where to draw those lines, but yeah. And in any given life, we're not all three of those all the time. We're not all three of those all the time, but that's what I believe we benefit by striving for. And that's a struggle for me. And I know this is going on the internet, but most of those people will never meet me. Because I tend to be a type A, which means, here's the task, let's get it done. And a lot of this other stuff, if I'm not careful, I'll start thinking, well, that's just taking too long. Well, sometimes it does take too long, but sometimes taking a little longer to get it done with the group's involvement has great benefits at the end. I just wish I'd learned it a little younger. But, and I'm getting into next Monday's lesson, but there are times when we need to be decisive and authoritative in church leadership. We have a false teacher comes in. Let's don't call a business meeting to decide if that's right or wrong. A church leader has to take a stand. And what do you do if there's no church leader, the elders or deacons aren't there? Well, somebody's got to stand up. I was talking to a sister, or a couple in Christ. It kind of blew my mind, but it wasn't in a church service, but they were in a group discussion, and there was Christians and non-Christians there, but this couple, along with their elder, was in it. And one of the non-Christians started talking about how homosexuality isn't that bad, and it's an acceptable thing. And this couple kept waiting for their elder to speak up. And he never did. And finally, I don't remember if it was the man or the woman, but this couple felt compelled to say something. I don't fault them in that case for saying something. I just thought, how sad. And it could have been a person who was an officer in name only. I don't know. I wasn't there, but... There are times when you need to be decisive. But what I believe, Joanne, and again, you'll forget this by the time I get to it down the road, there is no one style that's always right. There are multiple styles that are sometimes right depending upon the situation. There are times to be decisive. There are times to be patient. There are times to get inputs. There are times you have to just say, this is the way we're going, and the wisdom comes in deciding which ones are which. Anybody else care to? I don't get a good span here, so. Okay, let's go to, I don't know how, I'll just leave that up there. You can just ignore that. I'd like to spend a little time now, maybe the rest of our time, depending on how much you have to say, about dealing with out-of-control situations. And I started out with this, thinking about within the assembly. So we'll start there, but you can have out-of-control situations that aren't in the assembly. I'm just going to pose the question, and then I'm going to pause, and if you want to comment on how you might think it would be good to handle this, fine. If you don't, then I'll tell you the right way to do it. And then we'll go to the next one. Okay? There are there aren't right ways, there are wrong ways, but there are multiple right ways. We're in the assembly, and somebody raises their hand and says, I've got something I want to say. It's unscheduled. They haven't visited with the elders. They just say, I want to say something. We're not in class. Usually this happens at announcement time, and they want to come forward and say something. How would a Christian, how would you counsel an elder, or you if the elders aren't there, to handle that? What would you do? It sure happens. It happened within the last 6 weeks at one place I was at. It happened when I was 9 years old at Martinsville, Indiana, and I haven't forgotten it yet. Although the parties are dead. How do you handle that? Well, that's one way to handle it. Just sit there. Just sit there and listen. Okay, I'll break the ice if there is any ice. I'll tell you what I would say. I think it is quite appropriate for an eldership, and in the absence of an eldership, whoever are the surrogate leaders or whatever, to ask to speak to that person privately before they turn the pulpit over to them. Because you have absolutely no idea for sure what is going to come out of their mouth. I think an eldership has every right to say, we'd be happy to consider what your thoughts are, but we as an eldership would like to visit with you first before it. And the time that I saw it just a few weeks ago, and some of you were there, is exactly the way they did it. And I almost stood up and applauded because it doesn't always happen that way. When I was 9 years old in Martinsville, Indiana, they were disciplining somebody. And I can't remember if they were disciplining a man or a woman. But another man says, I got something to say. He walks up, the elder gave him the pulpit, and he went on for 5 minutes. Finally, one of the ladies in the congregation stood up and started yelling at him that he was going to send us all to hell and stormed out. And then this guy looked at the elder and said, what would you like for me to do? And the elder finally said, I'd like for you to sit down. He should have said that 4 minutes and 59 seconds earlier. And I'm not overly sensitive, but I still remember that 52 years later. Now, we can do this without being cruel, but the pulpit is a powerful place, and elders, leaders, and if we don't have elders or they're not there, somebody has the right to say, we'd like to visit with you about that. And you can do that in a nice way. Randy. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And sometimes this person just hasn't thought to inform the elders, but sometimes they probably have thought and knew that if they did inform the elders, they wouldn't get the pulpit. And I'm not accusing anybody. That's just not the place for it when we've got visitors. Well, it's not the place for it even if we don't have visitors. But it does happen. And I'd be surprised if 90% seen it happen in some way, shape, or form. And it can get kind of nasty getting them down. Now, you can turn the mic off, but that doesn't always work. Okay. Anybody have anything more you want to say about that? Janice?
I was present in San Jose one time when a guest speaker from the pulpit was talking teaching some false doctrine.
Mm-hmm. Did you all hear her? Okay. I would try to paraphrase it if you didn't, but I don't want to paraphrase. Yeah, sometimes people from the pulpit, and that may happen in the hour after lunch sometime this week will say something that's not correct. Well, how do you handle that? That can be an out-of-control situation. My thinking on that, it has so much to do with the attitude of the person who said it. Everyone who stood behind a pulpit has said things wrong. But there's a difference in my mind between innocently saying something because we don't understand it and saying it because we're trying to influence people away. And the age of the person has something to do with it. We've all sat there when a young person was saying something and maybe it wasn't totally wrong, but it wasn't quite right. Well, you could just crush that person. So there's a way to instruct them a little bit later, but you have to use some judgment. But I think to let a mature person speak things that are blatantly undoctrinal from the pulpit and not have it corrected in some way and have people leave the assembly with any chance of assuming that's the way the group believes is probably a serious mistake. You have to balance that with making a mountain out of a molehill. Because when you correct somebody publicly, that half of the people that wouldn't have remembered what he said are now going to remember it, but hopefully they'll also remember your correction. Dwayne?
If a person says something that's blatantly wrong during the public service, and then the eldership does not publicly take a position against that.
Yes. Okay, could you hear that? Okay, he's saying if something like that happens and none of the leadership, official leadership, does anything, is it appropriate for the membership? Well, I'm going to fudge on that a little bit by saying you got to look at that case by case, but I don't want to fudge very much. I would be very hesitant to usurp the authority of my eldership. In a case like that, if at all possible, I would probably go to my eldership after the service and say, I strongly disagree with that, and I think we ought to have a correction. And see if they agree. If they don't agree, then you got another issue between you and your eldership. But I think that the eldership has a unique responsibility there, and we ought to honor and also encourage them. I'll give you...
Is there any way we can turn this off for a second, the tape?
Someone comes forward for membership and you don't know them. What do you do? Well, I take the same approach that I take on this. If somebody comes forward and wants to be baptized, let's don't discuss that. Let's make sure they understand it. Let's take their confession, because that's a salvational issue. But if someone wants to come forward and place membership at your congregation and the elders haven't had a chance to talk to them, I think they owe it to themselves and to this person to have that dialogue. And I have no problem and have done it numerous times when I was an elder, said, we are really pleased that so-and-so has come forward and the elders are going to take an opportunity to visit with them, and we'll get back to you and let you know how this is going to work out. Because I don't want them to join a church that they don't understand and they could just walk off the street. Or you could end up embracing someone as a member that you don't know, that doesn't believe what you do believe, and then you've got an undoing. So leaders, and we're all leaders, don't get backed into a corner where you have to do something without having a chance to sit down and think about it. There has been times when I was an elder, and I was two different times, and other elders, even if I was pretty sure what we wanted would do as an eldership, I would say, but I need to talk to the other elders about it, to give me time to think about it and to give everybody time to think about it. Other than being baptized, which is a salvational issue, most other things can be dealt with in a little more calm manner. And I have seen situations where even an elder allows themselves to get back into a corner of having to make a snap decision. And seldom is that needed and seldom is that wise, in my opinion. Anybody want to comment on that? I know you young people don't have to deal with this. All I can say is, trust me, your time in the barrel's coming. So maybe you'll remember something that somebody said. Mike, was that your hand?
Yes. Even on the issue of baptism, if you don't know the person at all, it may be appropriate to have a little bit of discussion with them just to be sure they understand.
Absolutely.
What it is that they're doing.
Yeah, I think you can have, but you can have that relatively quickly, and I would personally not put that off to even the night, if possible. You can have a 5-minute conversation with them and see I don't believe you have to know a whole lot to become a Christian. And if someone says, I believe Jesus is the Son of God and I understand that baptism is for the remission of sins, if I get the right answers to that, I'm not going to be the one that tells them no. But I do agree with that. And then the sanctification process starts. Sure. And this is sometimes happens with young children. I want to make sure they've visited with their parents and so forth. Anybody else have a comment or question on that? What about disruptive attitudes in the worship service? And by this I mean, and I've seen this happen, people just laugh and giggle all through church, and it disturbs the whole tenor of the service, and certainly distracts the people around them. How do you handle that? Well, I know what your Attila the Hun wants to do. Anybody want to comment on that? Joanne?
Well, it depends on what the disruption is. Sometimes I had a lady recently said, when I sat in front of her with, I probably have more kids than I have now. You know, her first thought was to move. She hates sitting behind people with kids.
Sure.
And then when she saw they were well behaved, she thanked me after the service for the children out of the kitchen at church. So,
yeah. If kids distract you, just move to the front. You know, I don't want to get into pet peeves, but sometimes people will tell me, well, I don't come to church because I can't hear. Well, they sit on the back row. Sit on the second row and you could hear. Well, I don't want to sit on the second row. Okay. Well, my conversation ends kind of there. I prefer sitting up front. But I don't always. When I go in to visit congregations, I always sit on the first two rows. Two reasons. One, I'm not distracted. And two, I know I'm not going to ever be taking somebody else's seat. Nobody sits there. Nobody sits there. So you're in good shape. I don't know why that is. Now, you've done pretty good here. But isn't it amazing how we get our own assigned seats? I knew where most of you are going to be sitting today based on where you sat yesterday. Now you move a little bit, a few of you, but you give you another day and you're dead. Or not dead. You're set in your ways. Okay. Dan. Yeah, that.
A real different kind of
thing
that we've had.
Yeah, I'm with you totally on that, but that's I don't want to say, yeah, it is unique. It is unique, but that's different. There's a freshness about some of that that's kind of appealing. But that wasn't what I remember when I was, and of course I'm going back remembering these nightmares I had as a kid growing up, because I had a pretty rough childhood. It was rough. Yeah. But there was these two guys in their early 20s that would sit on the back row in Martinsville, Indiana, and they did it on purpose. They would laugh and giggle, and just all through church. And I mean, you could hear it clear up front. And finally, one of the elders called them on it. And
during the service, Chuck.
Mm-hmm. And one of them quit doing it because his dad got on him, and the other one, I don't know, he kind of quit coming. But it was just so bad that I can remember it as a little trial. I thought it was a test of the leadership, of great disrespect. But you have to use some judgment here. You have to use some judgment. What's the motive of the people doing it? We're just about out of time, and I know you're all wanting to talk about dress in the assembly, but since Randy will explain exactly how we handle that tonight in his talk, I probably won't do that until tomorrow, and then we can all remember the good points. I don't know what Randy's going to say. I just know it's about appropriate attire. But that's another issue where elders may wonder, do they need to take a position? Or we as a congregation need to take a position. And I'm not talking about, you know, multicolored things. I'm talking about things that might question us in terms of modesty. But each case can be a little different. So I'm not going to tell you how to handle that one today. I'll let you think a little bit about that. Does anybody have another question or comment? I've got about 2 minutes. Anybody that hasn't talked, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way, Dwayne. Okay, Dwayne. That's never been an option for me to exercise. I would just become fodder or bait. But some of you could do that. I remember I worked in a bakery for 8 years through high school and college for an elder at the church of one of the churches in Martinsville. Some of you knew Woody Estes. And every once in a while I'd be working. It was open all night, and these drunks would come in. And I mean, everyone was bigger than me. And Woody could tell I was having trouble. And Woody was a pretty burly guy. He came up and had this big butcher knife in his hand and just sat there. They left. I'm never so glad to see that man in all my life. So, let the butcher knife be a tool of our leaders. You're dismissed for 10 minutes.